This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Mark Jerome Walters, a veterinarian, journalist, and associate professor of journalism and media studies at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. Mark has been a visiting lecturer at Harvard Medical School and an associate at Harvard's Center for Health and the Global Environment. He is the author of 5 books, including 6 Modern Plagues, A Shadow and a Song, and Seeking the Sacred Raven. Mark Jerome Walters is here today to tell us about his most recent book, 7 Modern Plagues and How We Are Causing Them, a revised and expanded edition of 6 Modern Plagues and published in 2014. Welcome.
Thank you.
What led you to write your book, 7 Modern Plagues?
Well, it was really a matter of amazing timing because at the time I was finishing up veterinary school, we saw a number of new diseases just coming over the horizon. And it so happened that at the time I was in veterinary school in the 1990s, that people were beginning to view human health in a very different way from before. For a long time, they saw human health in one box, animal health in another, and what we call environmental health in yet a third box. But at the time I was finishing up veterinary school, I was lucky enough to be a part of an emerging movement in which those three areas of health were overlapping. And in other words, people saw human health, animal health, and environmental health deeply entwined with each other. It was a field called ecological health, and it brought together different institutions with these different focus on human, animal, and environmental health. And really, it's like adding two primary colors that all of a sudden you created another color. And so about that time, we saw Lyme disease taking off. West Nile virus was right down the pike. Mad cow was finishing its run. All sorts of new types of influenza. Then there was HIV, which was still heating up. And so when I graduated from veterinary school, I could see, wow, what I learned in these books is actually taking place in the real world. And so it's at that point I began to look at the various diseases around me and using those as really textbook cases of this new perspective on health, which is to say human health, animal health, and environmental health are all inextricably linked. And I thought that was well worth a book, and as it turned out, it was.
Before we go into detail, what are the 7 plagues you have chosen to talk about in your book, and why did you choose these particular diseases?
Well, I talk about mad cow, HIV, AIDS, antibiotic resistance, using a salmonella as an example, Lyme disease, hantavirus, West Nile virus, and pandemic flus. I chose those for a couple of reasons. Number one, they were the diseases just coming over the horizon that were very visible, but they also were great examples of how what we usually consider to be a human disease actually is a lot more than that. It's often also an animal disease, or at one point in its history was, and also as often these were linked in one way or another, it seemed, to changes in the environment. So they were great textbook cases of this new perspective on ecological, or sometimes called one health.
Would you say more about why you consider infectious diseases to be an ecological problem?
Well, one reason is because if you look at historically, and I mean ancient history, diseases seem to have come in great waves. And the waves in which they have come usually corresponded in some way, it seems, to human behavior. So ages ago, you could imagine, 10,000 or more years ago, when people really began forming into settlements with animals and agriculture, probably a time that gave rise to lots of diseases. Also a time many, many centuries later, when international trade or commerce and travel began to take place, with armies moving, trade routes established, there seemed to be another huge resurgence in disease. And now, when we look at the resurgence, current wave of new diseases, so many of them seem to be linked to changes in the environment. Some of these are speculative. Some have a very, very solid scientific footing. But clearly, something like mad cow, well established that that emerged from a disease in sheep, scrapie, which was really begun by changing the way people fed cows. They turned cows into carnivores rather than herbivores. They fed them the meat from sheep, and that spread the disease. Lyme disease, for example, very, very good evidence that changes in forest, in the nature of forest, fragmentation gives rise to Lyme disease. Flus, almost invariably the pandemic flus, a lot of evidence that those are linked to agricultural practices. And so you can just look at what's happening. You can say, wow, there are some very strong connections there. But the larger point that I think is called the underpinning of all of this, different organisms have different ways of surviving. They have a couple of different reproductive strategies. If you look at all the little things that run the world, as E.O. Wilson says, from the insects, and especially the microscopic organisms, viruses and bacteria, they reproduce very quickly. Their philosophy is, okay, dump thousands of offspring out there, don't give them any care, and let the fittest survive. Now, those sort of organisms are very good at adapting to the environmental change. You know, if you have 1,000 offspring and a sudden change in the environment, one of those is probably going to survive and pass on the genes. But if you come to the larger animals, like people, we have a totally different approach, and that is just have one or two and then take really good care of them. We're very poorly suited to environmental change. So it only makes sense from an ecological view that rapid environmental change favors the little organisms like the bacteria and the viruses that cause disease, favors them over the larger animals that often then become the victims of them.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but would you give an overview of the human activities that play a role in causing the plagues you speak about in your book?
Sure. I think a big one is agriculture. Now, if we look at, as I mentioned, mad cow, after World War II or during it, there was a huge emphasis on energy saving. And one way people figured they could save energy was not to waste any of the parts after butchering meat animals, for example, sheep. So rather than throwing out the parts that they once did, they turned them into a meal. They rendered them, it was so-called. And so they then could use that high-protein meat of other animals to feed the cows. There was an agricultural change that led to the emergence of mad cow disease. Let's take something like HIV/AIDS. Now, you might say this isn't agriculture of such, but it has everything to do with people trying to get the protein of the food they need. It's now been pretty well documented that the route for emergence of this virus, which began in a type of chimpanzee, was through the bushmeat trade. So hunters would go out and kill the chimpanzees. They would then bring them to the bushmeat market, some of them quite vast. I visited in Gabon, for example, where you see many different animals, chimpanzees, mandrills, you just name it. You see the body parts. Well, people butcher these. They get the bodily fluids on them. They get cuts. And you could easily imagine how this way of procuring food could transmit an infected chimpanzee and the blood of an infected chimpanzee to a person. And that seems to be the way it spread. I think the real granddaddy of agricultural diseases, though, is influenza. Now, all the types of influenza that cause the outbreaks every year, they originated in birds. And birds, this is where flus come from. One of the theories, for example, addresses the question, why do so many new influenzas, almost all of them, seem to emerge in Southeast Asia and then move around the globe? One theory, I think there's a lot of evidence for this, is that if we look at it historically, you know, in parts of China and the rice belt, you had thousands and thousands of acres of rice paddies. Naturally, those are going to attract wild ducks. And it's actually aquatic wild birds that carry these influenza genes. They are the native species, the home species for these types of influenza. Now, you can imagine they would land in the rice paddies. Well, the farmers also keep domesticated ducks there. So it would be very easy for a domesticated duck to then pick up this flu. There are also often pigs, swine, associated with these operations. And so you begin to see through agricultural systems how a wild virus could begin to work itself into an agricultural system and thereby begin to evolve. It creates a sort of laboratory for change, and how it could then very easily begin to infect people. And that seems to be exactly what's happening. The reason it's called bird flu, a couple of the recent types, or swine flu, as we saw the outbreak recently, the pandemic, was because those are the vessels that they pass through on their way to humans. The agricultural systems permit them to do that. So those are three good examples. I think climate change, in addition to agriculture, is certainly a big one. People have seen the West Nile virus, for example. The first outbreak in the late 1990s in the U.S. followed a drought, which was then followed by heavy rains. We see a similar pattern with hantavirus in the Southwest, in which it seems to be correlated with the patterns of El Nino in heavy rains in the spring. So there we covered two, agriculture, climate change. Now let's take what I think is a third one, which would be how we've changed the nature of forests. And Lyme disease really is a good example of that. To live in an area of fragmented forests, which is to say much of suburbia, is an actual proven risk for getting Lyme disease. Well, why is that? It's because the nature of the forest, the fragmentation, has changed the type of animals that live there and therefore the type that transmit it to people.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mark Jerome Walters, Associate Professor at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg, and author of the book, Seven Modern Plagues and How We Are Causing Them. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's focus a bit more on Lyme disease. Would you go into detail about the role of clear-cutting in Lyme disease?
Lyme disease is transmitted by and large by, well, traditionally thought to be deer, but also a type of mouse. Now, in an old-growth forest, let's say, where you have the native predators, it might be wolves or fox to keep down the mouse populations. You'd have a lot of raptors, for example, that would also prey on the mice. You would have a pretty good balance among the different types of animals, a well-established ecological balance. Now, as that forest is bisected, trisected, suddenly a 1,000 or 10,000 acre forest becomes fragmented into lots. Then you have no more large predators. The raptors have probably moved out, and the animals that move in are the opportunistic species. Now, deer would be attracted, for example, because along these leafy edges of the forest, there's lots of light, and that creates lots of browse, so there's a good supply of food for the deer. Also, there are very few predators on, say, the mice. And so you see that the two species that are a key to the transmission of Lyme disease, the tick that spreads the disease, suddenly have an increase in the population. And then people in proximity to that are therefore more likely to get Lyme disease. But it gets even more interesting because let's say you introduce another species that was lost back into that forest. Suddenly, that tick that might have bitten a mouse and transmitted it to people would have bitten, let's say, a skunk. And so the key here is that skunks just aren't as good as giving a home to that organism that causes Lyme disease as mice. So in other words, mice are very efficient transmitters of the disease. As it so happens, the increase in the mice creates a lot more opportunities for that organism to grow and to infect people. So it's by selectively eliminating certain species and increasing the opportunists, such as mice and deer, that gives an opportunity for that disease to spread to people. It's a question of biodiversity. A rich biodiversity in an area will decrease the risk of Lyme disease among people. Low biodiversity will increase the risk to people. One more interesting point that Richard Ostfeld, the scientist who has studied this extensively, has found is that acorns mass, which are those years that the acorns are produced in mass by the trees, 2 years following those years of large production, there seems to be an increase in Lyme disease among the animals. And that's because acorns attract the mice or the deer. They increase in population because they've had so much to eat the year before, and then they have more opportunity to spread it. So here you even see something such as a pattern of acorn production, rich some years, poor the other, for other years, has a basic effect on the pattern of disease in humans. So that's, I think, a clear ecological case study of how changes in biodiversity or in forest can directly impact the health of people, in this case, through Lyme disease.
How widespread is Lyme disease at present?
It's throughout the U.S. It tends to be focused in the Northeast, but it is a very widespread disease. It's interesting that here in Florida, we don't have too much of it. One of the theories is because we have a very, very rich biodiversity of animals, at least in many parts of Florida, so that it dilutes the possibility of it taking root in an efficient transmitter, such as a mouse, because there's so many choices that it can feed on. But certainly it is considered one of the major public health factors or problems in the United States. It's very widespread. It takes an enormous toll medically and just in terms of people being able to get outside recreationally and how people can appreciate or view the outdoors, at least in certain parts of the country.
What efforts have been taken to prevent the spread of Lyme disease, and how effective have they been?
As in most cases, a lot of what is done is research and dollars has been spent on curing rather than preventing. Now, the irony about Lyme disease is it's preventable. You can prevent Lyme disease. It might mean staying inside a lot more than you're accustomed to, and that's true. It requires a lifestyle change in some cases, certainly putting on some sort of repellent when you go out, or thoroughly checking, you know, for the ticks once you come in. So much of the effort, in addition to diagnosis and treatment of it, has been focused on simple human behaviors that really are very, very effective in preventing it, much like washing your hands and preventing other infectious diseases. The idea of if or when this new sort of information is going to change the larger patterns of human behavior remains to be seen. Will this have some influence on how much we partition or how much we fragment forest? Will these diseases have an impact on how we farm? These are such economically ingrained global issues that one hopes in time this new awareness will begin to affect the larger patterns. But then again, you look back historically and you see how once cholera was traced to sewage, cities were remade. People did not build cities the same way ever since. And so the point is that when certain links are made to health, people can make the fundamental changes that will help to prevent them as opposed to simply try to cure them once they're here.
Which of the plagues you speak about in your book are currently of the most concern?
Well, I think many of them are, partly because we don't know what they're going to do next. I do think that mad cow is understood. It's certainly become very rare, even in animals now, although there are certain cases of it. HIV, certainly more effective treatment for it and preventative means are being found. West Nile virus, a huge problem. Lyme disease, as I mentioned, continues to be. You know, I think probably the one of most concern at this point is pandemic influenza. It's been very unpredictable. There are some types of influences circulating now, at least in parts of the world, that have the potential to become serious pandemics. You have the bird flu, two types of bird flu actually, that are circulating, and it may only take a few genetic changes before these can cause a huge problem in people. The recent swine flu is just one, almost a footnote in this whole story of what's going on with influenza. Fortunately, it didn't turn out to be as bad as many people had feared, although the toll was still considerable. But I think that any flu season brings a tremendous risk of the garden variety of flu turning into a pandemic flu. And a pandemic flu is a flu to which people have very little natural or acquired immunity. Now, you and I and everybody we know has some immunity to influenzas of the past because either we've had that flu or been exposed to it. So they're not newcomers to our body's immune system. So if one of those related flus comes up this next season, our body, it recognizes it and can generally fight it pretty well. But pandemic flus are new. They are major changes in the genetic makeup, often occurring, you know, from birds or in pigs, for example, such that our bodies don't recognize it, and therefore they can be devastating with a much higher mortality rate than the seasonal flu. It's a major concern. There are major efforts to try to find a universal vaccine that would protect against all flus, increase research into ways to predict the particular strain that will be coming in the future, the next season, so that people can prepare a vaccine that works well. But I certainly think that influenza is probably about the biggest blip on the radar of public health agencies and organizations around the world, including the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And I think a close second to what I just mentioned in terms of the influenza has to be antibiotic resistance. That's a very serious thing in which the overuse of antibiotics and the use of certain antibacterial agents in soaps, for example, is really triggering the rise of some antibiotic-resistant disease. Fortunately, the FDA has begun to take certain steps in limiting the use of antibiotics. In my own field, for example, there's been really largely unrestricted use of human antibiotics among animals. And most of them are not used to treat sick animals. They're used as growth promotants, presumably because they help keep disease subclinical and enable animals to grow faster. But large amounts of antibiotics, for example, are given to livestock. That has been responsible for the creation of some very dangerous types of salmonella, for example, because if a steer has been treated with these antibiotics, then certain of the salmonella are going to survive and be passed on. The ones that survive become resistant to that antibiotic. And so if somebody then takes the meat home, they fail to prepare it, to cook it properly, and they become infected by that strain of salmonella, then they go to the doctor who reaches on the shelf to treat them with an antibiotic similar to what that animal had received to make it grow faster. Well, naturally, that's going to be resistant. So there are many dozens of infectious diseases, bacteria that are growing resistant to antibiotics because we have used them carelessly. And there's a great deal of effort now underway to limit the use, to develop new antibiotics, although those in the pipeline are very, very limited. And that is another issue, and I think in addition to influenza, that is very, very high priority among public health organizations.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mark Jerome Walters, associate professor at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg, and author of the book, Seven Modern Plagues and How We Are Causing Them. What are the best steps we can take to address the underlying causes of the plagues you speak about in your book?
I think it all begins with awareness. Some people have asked me, well, what's the point of all the theories and knowledge behind this if it doesn't solve the problem? Well, all solutions begin with a level of awareness of their causes, and I think we're just in the very early stages of this. There are changes that can be made in certain agricultural practices. For example, even CDC's website made the recommendation that farmers not have their duck ponds near their pigs. So that way you don't get swine flus mixing with bird flus and creating all sorts of mischief. So there are those sorts of steps one can take. I think in terms of the climate-related ones, hantavirus or West Nile virus, unfortunately, climate change is a long-term problem. It's going to take a long-term solution. We can all do what we can in terms of fuel efficiency and that sort of thing because they all impact ultimately on disease. So I think as a practical matter, people need to take practical precautions. So Lyme disease is to protect yourself by proper clothing, by tick checks when you come in. And for the larger issues, to take those small steps towards sustainability that may seem meaningless on a personal level, whether it's recycling or getting rid of your incandescent bulbs and using LEDs. But when you take that sort of behavior and the size of a country as the U.S., little by little it can have an impact.
How would you evaluate the efforts that have been made so far to address the plagues you speak about in your book?
Well, again, most of the efforts have been to cure rather than prevent. But there are some very encouraging signs, I think. CDC, for example, has implemented a program for research grants for municipalities to look at how environmental changes affect health. And so I think little by little, we're beginning to see changes here. I think that you look at some of the organizations that deal with environmental issues, and they're beginning to build into their philosophies and programs things such as conserving larger areas in suburbia, for example, that will really address things like Lyme disease. So it's a very tough problem. It's intractable in some ways, but we have to begin somewhere. I think that government is attempting to take some efforts, but it falls far, far short of what's needed. But at the same time, I like to try to stay encouraged by seeing those little spots, bright lights, where they're occurring.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
My goal is to have people, or public health people, is when they come across a case of influenza or see a new season beginning, that they'll say, this is a disease that human behavior really has caused. When they hear about HIV or Lyme disease, that they're aware of that, wait a minute, I'm not just a pure victim in this whole thing. I've also helped to cause these. And I think that by seeing ourselves less as victims and more as, let's say, co-conspirators is really the first step in trying to take a longer-term view of these things. And finally, I hope that they'll begin to use the term ecodemics when they speak of what has really been epidemics, because when we speak of ecodemics, built into that word is the whole idea that it's changes in environment that are sparking many, many of these new diseases that we're seeing.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message is along the lines that I spoke of, is that we are not helpless victims against disease. We are co-conspirators. We will never drive disease to the fringes of human existence. It will always be part of the human condition, and that the best we can do is to find a way to live in an ecologically wise way, that we, in some sense, co-inhabit the world with these diseases, as opposed to thinking we can simply destroy them. We have to help prevent them. One example would be antibiotic resistance. We have helped create many vicious infections simply through the overuse of antibiotics. There's an example. We can live with less severe forms of many infectious diseases if we could just find the wisdom to do that and not feel that it's our right or within our power to drive every infectious threat really out of existence, because it will never happen. We will tend to only make them worse.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Mark.
Okay, thank you very much.
You are just listening to Mark Jerome Walters, Associate Professor at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg, and author of the book, Seven Modern Plagues and How We Are Causing Them, published in 2014 by Island Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.